From Maine Public Radio and mainepublic.org, I'm Nora Flaherty, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Tuesday, December 20th, 2016. And on this day, a somewhat surprising announcement from the state that it plans to spend almost $2.5 million to increase access to drug treatment. And the future role of immigrants in taking care of New England's elderly population. That's ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
The Department of Health and Human Services says it will spend $2.4 million on an initiative that will give people more access to medication-assisted treatment for addiction. The announcement surprised treatment advocates. In the past, they've criticized the LePage administration for making it harder to access methadone and Suboxone amid an opioid crisis largely responsible for more than 270 overdose deaths last year. Steve Missler has our story.
DHHS Commissioner Mary Mayhew says the plan will benefit the 300 to 450 uninsured Mainers who are actively seeking treatment but who are unable to receive it. The additional dollars, most of which will come from a federal grant, will create nearly 360 additional treatment slots at facilities across the state beginning January 1st.
This is a public health issue, and in order to address it, we must take a multidisciplinary approach.
Officials say the federal funds come from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, but they did not disclose the state's share of the spending. The additional treatment slots are focused primarily in northern and eastern rural areas of the state. Mayhew says the allotments are based on a survey of 72 agencies and 38 private substance abuse providers.
Each slot will focus on helping the uninsured. It will include either access to Suboxone or methadone coupled with therapy.
The announcement was welcomed by treatment providers such as Brent Miller, the director of the Discovery House in Bangor, which will receive 160 new treatment slots with the funding. The Discovery House in Calais will see a boost of 100 more. The two locations account for 70% of the new slots that will be made available after the first of the year. Miller says that's good news for the 80 or so uninsured patients currently awaiting treatment in Bangor.
This, I hope, is a harbinger of those of the return to the realization that the only way to treat a disease is to get treatment.
Medication-assisted treatment is considered by scientists, doctors, and treatment providers as the gold standard for opioid addiction. But advocates for the approach say it has not been easy convincing the LePage administration to expand access. Since taking office, LePage has successfully pushed for a 2-year cap on methadone and Suboxone treatment unless patients get special permission to continue. He has tried and failed to end main care coverage for methadone treatment. Lower Medicaid reimbursement rates to treatment providers have been blamed for the closure of two major treatment facilities in southern Maine, one operated by Mercy Hospital and another operated by Spectrum in Sanford. And efforts to increase reimbursement rates have stalled in the legislature amid resistance from the LePage administration. Last summer, DHHS announced that it wanted to impose additional requirements for methadone and Suboxone providers, including additional counseling. And then LePage made these remarks on Bangor radio station WVOM.
I've been trying to close down methadone clinics since I've been governor, and we're raising the price and everything. And I tell you, there is, when it comes to methadone, every expert I have spoken to says if there's no clinical aspect to it, if it's just you stop by and get your drug and leave, it's useless.
The state's 10 methadone clinics are regulated by a half a dozen state and federal agencies, and the counseling the governor was talking about is actually required to receive the drug. Still, medication-assisted treatment advocates feel like they've had a hard time convincing the LePage administration to buy into expanded access effort backed by the federal government. And State Representative Drew Gatteen says that's what made today's announcement so surprising.
So anytime you see the department make an announcement that they're going to expand access to treatment, in particular medication-assisted treatment, I think that's a big deal and something that we should all support.
Jim Cohen, an attorney representing a coalition of methadone treatment providers, says the initiative is a small step toward addressing massive treatment needs statewide.
It doesn't end the work that we need to do. We need to continue to move ahead to address that serious need. But I think we should recognize the positive accomplishment of today's announcement.
DHHS Chief Mary Mayhew rejected the notion that the administration has been resistant to Medicaid-assisted treatment.
That's not true.
Mayhew says the efforts that have affected methadone clinics were not designed to erect barriers to treatment, but to ensure that the state and federally funded clinics are accountable in providing a consistent level of care.
So that we're not creating a fragmented approach to someone's care, and that their addiction to substance abuse is part of a much more holistic and comprehensive approach to their care.
The cumulative impact of the new initiative is unclear. According to the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, between 25,000 and 30,000 people seeking long-term drug treatment in Maine last year were unable to get it. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Steve Missler.
Opponents of the successful citizen initiative to legalize recreational marijuana in Maine are calling for tough restrictions as the law begins to be implemented. Mal Leary has details.
Members of the No on One Coalition that opposed the ballot question are urging lawmakers to adopt tough regulations and policies around the measure. It was approved by voters last month. At a State House news conference, No on One's Scott Gagne cited the close margin of victory for supporters and pointed to provisions in the law that need to be addressed.
First and foremost, the loophole that allows for the lawful possession of marijuana by youth must be closed immediately. We believe this was a mistake in drafting. However, the campaign is over now. It is time to both acknowledge and very quickly address this critical hole.
And Gagne says the legislature should virtually ban all advertising by pot retailers and prohibit the sale of certain edibles, such as gummy bears, citing the experience of Colorado after passage of its marijuana law.
Frankly, we would propose looking at banning certain types of edibles that are inherently appealing to youth. These products will pose one of the biggest risks to youth because of their innate appeal to children.
David Boyer, who headed the campaign in support of Question 1, acknowledges the edibles issue as it relates to minors. Colorado, he says, acted this summer to address the issue.
They banned edibles that were in the shape or colors that would be attractive towards minors, and we agree with that. What we don't agree with is an outright ban on edibles. We don't think that makes sense and would just encourage a black market.
Boyer says his group would agree to any fair changes needed to implement the law.
So long as the will of the voters remains intact, and that's that we're making marijuana legal for adults and giving them a safe, legal place to purchase marijuana. So, you know, with this issue, I'm sure the legislators we'll put something in quickly if there is an issue.
The initiated measure would have the Department of Agriculture develop the rules to oversee the sale of marijuana in the state. Governor Paul LePage, in his weekly radio appearance on Bangor radio station WVOM, says that makes little sense. He says the legislature needs to decide how to regulate the industry and give the executive branch the money and authority to do the job. He suggests the Bureau of Liquor and Lottery is a better place to establish oversight.
It's going to be $5 or $6 million, or they can send it over to Bablo, and maybe we can get away with maybe just hiring more people because the infrastructure is already there. But short of them giving me money, I don't do anything.
Attorney General Janet Mills says lawmakers have to act quickly to correct any immediate problems created by the initiative, including any loopholes affecting the possession or use of marijuana by minors.
People need to sit down and fix those provisions and make sure it is regulated like alcohol. For instance, if you're running a social club or distributorship or of some sort and you sell to a minor, what is the intent there? There's just no penalty in the bill.
Mills says she has often seen citizen-initiated bills based on language crafted in other states with different laws.
There are problems with this bill, and it's quite different than the law that the Commonwealth of Massachusetts just passed. It's quite different than the law in Alaska. It's quite different than the law in Colorado.
Mills says she has drafted legislation that would establish a cannabis commission to advise the legislature on implementation issues. She says all sides would be represented on the panel. They would make recommendations to the legislature on how to address both known and emerging issues. Legislative leaders say there are several bills being drafted for the session that begins in January in response to Question 1. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Mal Leary.
Mainer's personal income grew at a 1.1% rate in the third quarter of this year. That matched the national figure and was a little bit below the New England average of 1.2%. The biggest chunk of that increase in Mainer's personal income was in wages, that's as opposed to dividends or government payments. The Bureau of Economic Analysis information out today shows that wages rose most in wholesale trade and insurance and finance businesses. Is an old region, and not just historically. The population here is aging faster than almost any other place in the country. Fewer people are having kids, and many of the states struggle to keep younger generations here. As baby boomers grow older and live longer, the need for healthcare workers grows. In the second part of the New England News Collaborative series, Facing Change, Shannon Dooling takes a look at who's caring for aging New Englanders.
So the same thing with elders who are really old. They don't need 24-hour nursing care.
Standing at the front of a classroom, an instructor writes basic medical definitions on a whiteboard. Nine students from all over the world scribble down notes and shout out answers in unison.
So she calls 911, the ambulance comes, and they take him where?
ER.
Perfect.
30-year-old Ayu Lako sits next to classmates from Nepal, the Dominican Republic, and Jamaica. They're all here for a class called Working with Frail Elders at Boston-based Jewish Vocational Services. It's a nonprofit job training program focused on specific industries like food service and healthcare, both sectors facing labor shortages. Taking a break from the lecture, Lako says that after about 2 months, the course is going well.
That was good. I like it.
What do you like about it?
You know, I don't have experience before, but I want to be like nursing in the future. This is a good start for me. Before I got my baby, I used to work in the parking place, yeah.
Lako was a fashion model in Ethiopia before she arrived in Boston 4 years ago on a diversity visa. Her baby son was born here, and she's hopeful that with this training, she won't need to return to her job as a parking attendant. She says to check back with her in 5 years.
You can't see me like after 5 years, just start nursing. I'm going to be like full-time nursing. This is a good start to have a good bridge for registered nursing.
Our students come to us in lots of different ways.
Jerry Rubin is president and CEO of Jewish Vocational Services.
Some of our students are coming to us because they're recent arrivals in the country. They may have actually been refugees who have been resettled here, and they're coming to us through a refugee resettlement agency.
Established in 1938 to train recently arrived Jewish immigrants fleeing Europe, Rubin says classrooms are now full of Central Americans, Africans, and Europeans, all of whom have legal status in the U.S., These students, Rubin says, are the changing face of healthcare workers.
If you go into any segment of the healthcare industry, whether it's the acute care hospitals, community health centers, long-term care organizations, you're going to find a significant portion of the workforce are made up of immigrants. In fact, it's really the bedrock of the healthcare industry.
As of 2014, more than a quarter of the home health care workers in Massachusetts were foreign-born. 41% of the nursing assistants in assisted living facilities were also born outside of the U.S. And these numbers likely miss immigrants who work part-time or maybe here illegally and working under the radar. Reliance on immigrant labor for health care is only expected to increase, especially in New England, where there's a demographic storm brewing. The region is home to some of the oldest, whitest states in the country with the lowest birth rates. Adding all of this together reveals unsustainable labor trends. Barry Bluestone is a professor of public policy at Northeastern University, and he's run some of the jobs numbers.
In Massachusetts, we project we're going to need about 93,000 additional home care workers over the next 10 years, or almost 10,000 a year.
Bluestone says given the population projections for the region, namely a shrinking workforce, New England needs to plan accordingly. And he's concerned that national conversations around immigration could hamper those preparations.
These are overwhelmingly immigrant workers. And what I fear is if the current kind of political environment either shuts off immigration or potential immigrants look at the United States and say, this is not a very comfortable or safe place to be, I don't have any idea how we're going to fill those 10,000 jobs each year.
Over the course of his campaign, President-elect Donald Trump spoke of mass deportations of people in the country illegally and the need to toughen screening for refugees coming to the U.S. If put into place, experts say these actions could further strain an industry that already struggles to fill positions. Dr. Robin Stone is Senior Vice President of Research at Leading Age, a trade group for nonprofit elder care providers. Stone says meeting the need for care providers in the future is a labor opportunity for both immigrants and workers born here in the U.S. But she cautions that the native-born workforce is the same white working class that's expected to continually decline in numbers.
To think that we can fill all of these jobs for the huge demand that we're going to see in the next 25 years with just native-born folks is unrealistic.
Control in his right arm. He has drifting limbs.
And that's why training programs like this one at Jewish Vocational Services are so important. Ayu Lako, the student from Ethiopia, says she's hopeful that she'll eventually land her dream job in healthcare.
I'm thinking if I got like hospital or older home health aid, take care of people.
So while the future of immigration policy may be unclear, one thing we do know is there will be no shortage of people needing care. For the New England News Collaborative, I'm Shannon Dooling.
And that's This Day in Maine for Tuesday, December 20th, 2016. Thanks today to Ed Morin, John Bradford, and our digital team. I'm Nora Flaherty.